Welcome to the Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show. OuterLimitsRadio.com. I'm your host, Ryan. Today, we're going to devote an entire program to the physical and metaphysical aspects about the human heart. We have Dr. Steven Sinatra. We have Ms. Yona Brindis. We have Mr. Jeff Casper. They're all going to add something very unique to this discussion, and I can't wait to start the show. The Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show proudly presents a metaphysical discussion on the human heart. Joining us now is Dr. Sinatra, cardiologist and psychotherapist with over 40 years of clinical experience in treating heart disease. You can learn more about him by going to these two websites, heartmdinstitute.com and drsinatra.com. Dr. Sinatra, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's good to be here, Ryan.
Thank you. Okay, you've studied the heart a long, long time. What are some of the biggest factors that will determine how healthy your heart is? And actually, what are some of the things that a person can do right now to improve the vitality of their heart?
Well, I mean, certainly lifestyle characteristics overwhelm genetics. I mean, you know, when I was treating patients on a day-to-day basis, and if they had a family history of heart disease, like a death before 50 or a heart attack before 50, I would screen, the families of these patients, because certain characteristics are genetically carried down, like high homocysteine, for example, or high LP little A, or even C-reactive protein. Certainly, cholesterol factors can be carried down. So in other words, if you have some inflammatory genetic components that are transferred genetically, it's good to know that. It's very good to know that. But lifestyle characteristics trump genetics. For example, if my dad had a heart attack at age, let's say, 45, and he was a smoker and sort of an aggressive personality, ate poorly, never exercised, gained weight, and I saw that as a child, and I decided, I'm not going to be that way. I'm going to have a different personality. I'm not going to smoke. I'm going to stay trim. I'm going to go out for sports. Chances are I'm not going to have a heart attack. And they're really good chances. So basically, your lifestyle, your environmental factors trumps genetics. So even in families who have been, quote, dealt a bad set of genes, I strongly believe you can overcome that, with good lifestyles. Okay, now what are the good lifestyles to follow? Well, certainly a non-inflammatory diet is one. I sort of like a plant-based diet with animal protein. I eat organically as much as I can, or free range. The worst things about diet are the inflammatory producing factors, and in one word, Ryan, it's sugar. It's sugar. So soda out.
That.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, soda, for example, just brings nothing to the table. Dead calories. Drink water. Drink almond milk or anything, but don't drink sodas. I mean,
Let me pause you for 1 second. What is safer? Is it safer to drink the fluoridated tap water or soda? What would you say would be the lesson to do?
Well, okay, good point. Very good point. Tap water nowadays is getting worse and worse from the environmental point of view. I mean, lead is pervasive. The chemicals, insecticides, pesticides, now even phthalates, BPA. I mean, our water supply is getting more and more contaminated beyond the fluoride and the chlorine that a lot of waters have. So, you know, drinking healthy water is important. And I usually recommend this. If a family can afford it, I recommend reverse osmosis. You can put these systems underneath your sink. You change the filters once or twice a year. But the only problem with reverse osmosis is, like distilled water, it's dead water. In other words, it's water, but it doesn't have minerals in it. But it doesn't have chlorine in it. It doesn't have fluoride in it. It doesn't have insecticides or pesticides. So basically, you take the good, the bad, and the ugly out. So if you do have reverse osmosis water in your home, you need to fortify it with minerals. And there's lots of minerals that people can take. They can take them in liquid form, powdered form. I mean, there's certainly lots of minerals out there where you can replenish your body. But your point is well taken. Wherever I live, I always have my water tested. I always send it out to a place in the Midwest. It costs about $100, but it's worth it to know whether your water has mercury in it, lead in it, too much uranium. You can have radiation in it, for example. There's so many things in water.
We're just like the guinea pigs for these people.
Yeah, but there's good bottled waters you can buy as well. And we should stay on this because healthy water is probably the most important thing you can take for optimum health. I mean, as well as your heart. But the three waters that I like, I mean, I like Aquapana water. That sort of comes from an old Roman, you know, spring of antiquity, 2,000 years ago in Italy. I like Saratoga water. You know, you're from New York. I grew up in New York. But, you know, Saratoga Springs has a lot of minerals up there. Their flat water is very good. It's in glass, by the way, which I prefer glass over plastic. And I like Mountain Valley water. That's in a green bottle. So those three waters I prefer. And I have no relationship with those companies. I just like their waters the best. But your point is well taken. You have to drink healthy water. I mean, let's face it, the idea of healthy water would come from a glacier, that the sun is melting the glacier and the water is running down over rocks, getting lots of minerals and energized by the vibration of the sun's rays and the grounding of the earth, which replenishes energy into the water. So that type of water would have like what I call a high zeta potential. It's a high vibratory water. But the waters that we drink today, you know, they're reprocessed.
Reprocessed water. Isn't that nice? You can't even have, like, you know, reprocessed food, processed food. Now we get reprocessed water.
Water.
You can drink water.
And it's dark and dingy and plants and they're
GMO water.
They're underground and they're bottled in plastic and stuff like that. Hey, look, if you're dying of thirst, any water is good. Let's face it, even though it's lead in it, any water is good. But you know, if you can choose your waters wisely and you can spend a few more pennies on it, I would recommend it.
You know what? We're going to go to a place that I don't think we can go anywhere else with anyone else, because we did the interview with you previously with Tommy Rosa, and Tommy Rosa had a near-death experience. Did you ever have any kind of insight, or have you gotten any kind of insight on if you ingest something like that has been negatively charged, whether it be water, whether it be food, if that can have a negative impact in your heart? And I'll give you one example. There are people who choose not to eat meat because an animal experiences a tremendous amount of pain or suffering, and that energy gets embedded apparently on the flesh of that animal. You ingest that travels throughout your body. I'm curious if that has ever come up, or if a negatively charged plant or animal could have a negative impact on your heart.
You have a very good question, and it's a very valid question, and the answer is true. I'm a trained psychotherapist as well as a cardiologist, and when animals are slaughtered, if there's terror and fear in that animal before the animal is slaughtered and that's transferred to the flesh and you eat the flesh, I believe some of that energy can be transferred to you. I can remember as a doctor for years, I was very interested in patients' dreams because I was also a certified psychotherapist and I always was involved with the emotional and the physical aspects of healing. I've heard of nightmares in patients, and I asked them what they ate that day. And, you know, some of them ate, you know, again, red meat and steak and hamburger and stuff like that. So your point is well taken. And I've always told my patients not to eat veal because I thought and I never eat veal. And I thought the raising of calves was sort of inhumane, you know, when you sort of keep a calf in jail, so to speak, chained to an area where they can't, you know, walk or really run around and you know, just, you know, use their God-given their legs for exercise. And there must be a lot of anger, there must be a lot of depression, there must be a lot of, you know, negativity. And veal is an inflammatory food, by the way. And I've often wondered, I mean, this is not fact, Ryan, I'm just, you know, temporizing here, but I often wondered if when a calf is growing up, if that emotionality is transferred to the meat, because the meat is pro-inflammatory. It's a pro-inflammatory meat. Unlike like lamb is not a pro-inflammatory meat. So, your question is well taken. If you ever buy foods, this is where I think the humane killing, sort of the kosher style of killing or slashing the neck of a chicken, for example, and bleeding the chicken. I believe that's one of the, you know, more humane ways of killing, and the food may be tastier because of the way the animal was sacrificed. Look, there's no great way of sacrificing an animal, and you know, I used to be a fisherman for years. I can't even kill fish anymore. I mean, I feel guilty about it. But if I'm hungry and I want to eat the fish, sure, I'll kill it. But I just feel the same way about trees and plants. After meeting Tommy Rosa, you know, Tommy tells me that, you know, these plants have feelings.
Geez, so were they upset when we eat them?
What, the plants? I don't know. Sure. I don't know. That's a question for Tommy.
I have to come back to Tommy about that.
But that's a question for Tommy. But, you know, another pro-inflammatory situation is omega-6 oils, which, like canola oil, for example, or corn oil, or soybean oil. Not olive oil. That's an omega-9, mostly it has saturated and monounsaturated fats in it. But like these omega-6 oils are pro-inflammatory, and they cause, you know, harm to the body. And the worst oils are the trans fats. These trans fats and people need to read labels on, especially like a real dangerous food would be a microwave popcorn that has lots of trans fats.
Jeez.
Are really pro-inflammatory. These are like unguided missiles that eat out the inner lining of blood cells and really cause enormous inflammation. And remember, it's inflammation that causes, you know, plaque and heart disease. And inflammation is caused by some of the things we mentioned: heavy metals, insecticides, pesticides. We talked about water, and certainly trans fats, omega-6 oils. Your best oil, the secret sauce of the Mediterranean diet is olive oil. And then, the pro-inflammatory aspects and the emotionality of animals, we need to consider that. But I generally like more plant-based. I do recommend animal protein. I like wild migratory fish. Smaller fish I like because of the mercury factor and of the heavy metal factor, and also the pollution of the oceans and streams and lakes as well. So sardines, I would say, are the healthiest fish that you can possibly eat. They're loaded with coenzyme Q10. They have DMAE in it, which is a choline derivative that's great for the brain. They're loaded with calcium. And it's just probably the healthiest fish you can possibly eat, and they don't get big enough to get really mercury or lead or any of the environmental contaminants in it. So, you know, a healthy diet is number one, and again, a non-inflammatory diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, nuts. I mean, the 7-Day Adventists have shown us over and over again that a vegetarian way of eating, and especially nuts. Now, the PREDAMED study, the study that was done in Europe, that hands down showed that if people ate either 2 tablespoons of olive oil, extra virgin olive oil a day, or a couple of handfuls of nuts, their incidence of heart disease, cancer, depression, diabetes, metabolic syndrome was significantly less over a 5-year period than people who ate, like the American Heart Association, lower fat diet. So healthy fats are good for you.
Apparently, when you get older, can you only push your heart a certain rate? There's some people who run marathons. There's some people who, who've gotten into great shape. Is there a danger of pushing your heart too hard? I'm just kind of curious how hard can you push your heart? Is it dangerous to run marathons after a certain age?
Sure. First of all, it depends on how old you are. Let me use myself for example. I used to wrestle all through junior high, high school, and college. And, we used to go 3:33 in college, sometimes an overnight time, maybe 12 minutes. My heart rate was probably over 180, over max. In other words, the maximal heart rate for a person is like, you can figure it out. Basically, you can take like 170 minus your age and subtract. And for example, I'm 70 years old now, so if I had a heart rate of 120 to 130, that would be, you know, a good training heart rate. The maximal heart rate, I'm sorry, is 220 minus your age, and around 170 would be like an upper limit of normal for most people to really exercise at. But let me rephrase your question this way. People need to know that exercise can have a downside. I mean, the one exercise that is probably the worst is racquetball, or some of these interval trainings that we do where it's start, stop, start, stop, where you're
Oh, the high intense training.
Yeah, the high intensity. I'm not a big fan of interval training. I am not a big fan of it, because if you're not in that type of condition, and you suppose you're a 50-year-old guy and you say, I want to lose 20 pounds and I'm going to go jogging, then I'm going to sprint for a little while and then jog and then I'm going to walk. That's interval training. And the problem with that is, in an untrained individual, that can produce plaque rupture and heart attacks. Now, marathon runners have a high incidence of heart disease and sudden death for that factor. And the reason being is, and this is one of the lectures I give across the country, the reason being is when you do this much intense, high-intensity exercise, you get an antioxidant drain. In other words, I call it the athlete's unfair advantage, where they have an enormous antioxidant drain. They're losing Q10, they're losing vitamin E, they're losing magnesium. And even female athletes lose iron. That's why they get what we call primary amenorrhea, where these young women athletes, they even stop menstruating because the body knows it needs to conserve iron. So for any person who wants to embark on an exercise program, and my cutoff is age 40 now. I used to go 50 for a woman and 45 for a male, but, you know, with heart disease being more and more pervasive as time goes on, I dropped it to 40. So if anybody wants to embark on an exercise program, they need to, you know, have an exercise stress test and be screened with a minimum of an exercise test just to make sure that exercise is safe. Because the danger of exercise is this, and I've had so many cases in my practice like this. You know, a guy takes his car to a gas station and he gets an oil change, but they forgot to put the oil in it and they put a new filter in it. It seizes up 3 miles later. The guy gets out of his car, he starts pushing it, and he has a heart attack. I've had situations where men were picking up a TV or moving a refrigerator and had a heart attack. And when you do unaccustomed exercise and you're not trained, and if you have toxic emotions at the same time, that's like double handcuffs. So you never want to jog emotions when you're angry. I've had patients tell me, "Doc, I was so angry I went running." I go, no, don't do that. You don't want to do that, because the intensity of emotional stress superimposed on physical stress can sometimes raise the heart rate and blood pressure, you know, very, very high, and blood pressure tends to go up. It's like driving your car with your brakes on. So you have to be careful when it comes to exercise, and do it with a lot of diligence. And again, don't tie up your emotions. Don't have a bad emotional situation and use exercise as a way of dispelling it, because it can backfire on you.
Okay. I'm just curious also, what impact can TV or other forms of entertainment have in your heart? Like, if your brain is in a very negative state, or if you're watching TV, or if you're watching, I'm just curious to know if you've ever had experiences if, you know, a person sitting in front of the TV could actually have a negative impact on their heart because of what they're feeling, because of their reaction to what they're engaging in.
Good point. Again, this can be helpful or it can be hurtful. You know, people who watch TV, I'll give you, and again, you're asking me questions that I have real life events to give you, you know, real life situations. I had a guy in Connecticut, and I don't know if you remember the days when the men, and now it's the women, that were winning the national championships. I had a guy with advanced heart disease, and every time he watched a basketball game with UConn, he got severe angina, meaning he had a heart cramp. And I had to forbid him from watching those games because, you know, he showed up in the emergency room once, I had to admit him, and he did it again, and it almost killed him. I have to tell you, it was a bad situation because he got emotionally involved, you know, with the game. Same thing is true with people who, you know, are watching politics or watching movies, and they get really upset and they get angry. The best thing they can do is turn the TV off. However, go ahead, Brian.
No, I was going to say, I got to tell my parents, stop watching TV, stop watching the news.
Stop watching the news, because people
stop
get really
Fox
upset.
News.
Politics, the news, you know, the crime, the terrorism. However, let's be honest here. If they're watching a TV show and it makes them sad and they're crying and they're sobbing, so to speak, it's not the TV program or the movie that makes you sad. What the TV program, or if you go to a movie and you start crying in a movie theater, what it's doing is it's touching your sadness that we all have. All human beings have sadness. We all have elements of depression. We have, you know, we have that in our emotional and physical body. So let me give you an example. I grew up as a cardiologist. I grew up as a wrestler. I wrestled all through college, and I never cried as a kid because when my father used to, you know, tell me, if you don't stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about. I wouldn't cry, right, to get back at him. And I learned about this in my psychotherapy training. But then when I became a board-certified cardiologist, I realized that men who didn't cry got heart disease. And I even did research on it. it was something that really bothered me. So when I became a certified psychotherapist, I needed to do 200 hours of personal therapy. One of my aims was trying to touch my sadness and cry, and I couldn't do it. You know, even, you know, going to therapists and working with them, I just couldn't cry. However, certain movies made me cry. And one of them, the best movie that made me cry was Hoosiers with Gene Hackman. And I ended up seeing the movie 5 times because I knew it was healing me, because whenever you touch deep sadness with intense sobbing or crying, and that movie touched something in me. You know, Hackman was like my wrestling coach, and we were like underdogs a lot. And all, you know, it was a great movie, but it touched me emotionally. I got more out of crying watching that movie than I did in years of psychotherapy trying to get myself to cry, because I realized pent in emotions, especially sadness, can be devastating to the heart. That's why I wrote the book years ago, Heartbreak and Heart Disease, because if you cannot alleviate the heartbreak that we all have, and the best way to alleviate it is with crying, because crying will free up the heartbreak that can eventually lead to heart disease. So when you ask me the question about TV, yeah, it can be bad, and it also can be good.
It's, if you laugh, is that good for your heart?
Oh, that's phenomenal. Are you kidding me? Now, look, Ryan, what happens if you laugh so hard and you can't stop laughing? What happens after that?
You poop your pants.
You poop in your pants or you cry.
Yeah.
That's the beauty. Those are involuntary emotions. I can remember I worked with one of the world's greatest psychotherapists in bioenergetics. His name was Alexander Lowen. And he was a disciple of Reich, and he tried to get me to cry. And I, oh my God, some of the therapy was very painful. But one day he had me, had my chest, he was opening my chest over what we call a bioenergetic couch, a stool where your chest is wide open. And I started to laugh. And he said to me, he goes, "Oh, you think that's funny?" I go, "Yeah." So he started to tickle me right in my chest. And I started to laugh and laugh. But that's what he was after. He was after the endorphin relief of uncontrolled laughter is absolutely miraculous in healing the heart. You know, kids, they laugh 500 times a day. Oh, this is on my website, by the way, heartmdinstitute.com. If people would ever click on prevention of heart disease or sudden death, you know, I talk about this, because laughing, like if you watch Laurel and Hardy movies or the Pink Panther or any of these movies and you laugh, it's healing for the heart, no question. And if you laugh hard enough, you know, hopefully you'll cry. And if you can give yourself permission to cry, that's the most healing emotion you can do for your heart.
Oh, that's awesome to laugh. And like, say, for example, you find yourself in the unfortunate position where you start to have a heart attack. Is there anything you can immediately do that would push you in a better position or at least save your life?
If you think you're having a heart attack, what to do?
Yeah.
I would chew on an aspirin immediately.
Okay.
It could be any aspirin, a white aspirin, a 325, a baby aspirin, a couple of – I would chew on an aspirin and call 911, or if you're out in the sticks, just get somebody to take you to the hospital, because time is of the essence. Remember this, 50% of the time – that's why people go to my website, they can see this stuff. 50% of the time, the first symptom of heart disease is sudden death. So it's important to realize that, you know, if you're getting crushing chest pain, or if you're a male, or if you're getting intense jaw pain or neck discomfort, or if you're a woman, you break out into a sweat, you get short of breath for both men and women, you have dreadful fatigue, and you say to yourself, uh-oh, I never had this symptom before. This is something different. You've got to jump in a car or an ambulance, have somebody drive you, call an ambulance, chew on an aspirin, and get to an emergency room, because this is where modern medicine is at its best, when you can get an emergency stent or you can get an angioplasty, you can open up that vessel, and if you can get to the hospital within 2 hours, you can prevent a major heart attack, even sudden death for that matter.
Okay. And Dr. Sinatra, final question I have for you, sir. I'm enjoying this interview so much. Is, have you ever concluded or thought of the heart as being another, as being conscious, like the brain? We think of the brain as a directing, you know, energy.
Yeah.
But have you ever thought of seeing the heart as its own kind of frequency or consciousness?
Hey, Ryan, I got to tell you, I've been doing radio interviews for 40 years, and these few questions you asked me have been the most fun questions I've ever had to answer.
Oh,
and they're
pleasure.
Really
thank,
good.
I have to do that. Thank you.
And I'm not blowing smoke. Believe me, I'm telling you. I've been interviewed by the – I've been on TV, radio so many times. That's a superb question, and the answer is this. The heart is the king of the body. The heart rules the brain, and we've only learned this within the last 10 to 15 years with heart rate variability. And I'll say it this way. The heart is under the control of the autonomic nervous system, which means the vagus nerve, which means the sympathetic nervous system. You know how the nervous system is divided into the sympathetic branch and the parasympathetic branch. That's why grounding, when we did our interview with Tommy Rosen, we talked about grounding. What grounding does, it balances the autonomic nervous system. So if you're in terror, fear, anxiety, if you're upset, if you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, your sympathetic nervous system is on, you know, on high charge. If you put your bare feet on the ground, you cause a parasympathetic stimulation and you balance the sympathetic nervous system. Now, what we've learned is that heart rate variability is actually a maneuver. We can determine the heart rate variability of a person, but it's really what the heart is getting from the brain. In other words, the heart is telling us what's going on in the brain. We can not measure what's going on in the brain. I mean, we can with EEGs and, you know, brain scans and sophisticated technology, but nobody can, you know, you have to go to a hospital for that. But if your heart is reflecting what's going on in the brain and you have good heart rate variability, this is wonderful. This is optimum health. But if you have poor heart rate variability, this means, and any chronic illness will disturb heart rate variability. There's certain drugs that'll do it. For example, the drugs that men take for prostate problems, that we call them alpha blockers, or if asthma medications, sympathomimetics, this can have an adverse effect on heart rate variability. Anger, rage can have an adverse effect. Prayer, silence, meditation, qigong, tai chi, yoga, they have a positive impact on heart rate variability. Omega-3s have a positive impact, like fish oil or squid oil have a really good positive effect. Air pollution has a negative impact. It disturbs heart rate variability, especially when we're inhaling these very, very tiny particles on hot, humid days. So your question is this. The heart is the king of the body, but the heart reflects what's going on in the brain, and basically we can measure heart rate variability now with very, very easy techniques. It's very easy. We can even get a determination of heart rate variability from an exercise stress test. Here's a poor man's heart rate variability, Ryan. It's very easy. If somebody exercises, let's say you go to a gym, you get your heart rate up to 150, and after 5 minutes, it's still above 110, you have disturbed heart rate variability. You have something going on in your body that we need to investigate, something emotionally, something physically, but something is off. If after 5 minutes, if you're exercising at 150 and your heart rate goes below 110 into the 80s or 90s, you have good heart rate variability. So basically, even with electromagnetics, with Wi-Fi and EMF and, all these gadgets, cell phone towers, all these forces that we can't see, we can't feel, see, taste them, they have a negative impact on heart rate variability. So
that's incredible. So you're saying that Wi-Fi, because everyone has a laptop. I mean, I myself sit with a laptop, so that could be having a negative impact.
Yes. That's why kids, when they go to schools and they have industrial Wi-Fi penetrating cinder block, these little children, sometimes it has an adverse effect on the heart. They get headaches, they get lightheadedness, dizziness, nausea. You know, they can't find out what's wrong with them at school. The nurse doesn't know what's wrong. The doctors don't know what's wrong. And then all of a sudden they go home, they're fine. And on weekends they're fine. And then in the summertime they're fine. And then when they go to school, these things happen. But I'll tell you this. This is in our book, Health Revelations from Heaven and Earth, but people need to be aware that Wi-Fi has a downside. You can go to Wikipedia, Ryan, and there's a Wi-Fi sickness. It's defined. You know, it's a classic sickness that even conventional doctors know about. So what do? You go to Ethernet. You know, I'm on a computer. I have it plugged in. I don't have Wi-Fi in my house. The phone I'm talking to you now is wired. It's wired. It's not a cordless phone. It's a wired phone. When I talk on a cell phone, I put it on speakerphone, and I hold it 3 feet away from my body. You never want to put a cell phone in your pocket, because now the biggest problem in males today is sterility, because a cell phone pocket, you know, close to your testicles, you lower your sperm production 400% within 2 hours of having that radiation go right to your testicles. So, you know, sterility used to be the female problem. Now it's the male problem. So we have to be worried about EMF. But look, you know, we don't want to be destructive. We want to be productive. So the key is, how do you be productive without being self-destructive? Well, you use these gadgets smart. You know, you just have to use them smart. I'm not a big fan of cordless phones. I tell people to throw them out and get them out of the house because they're emitting, you know, radiation 24/7, and they adversely affect the heart. And by the way, I'm more worried about electromagnetics on the heart than I am brain cancer. I mean, it may take 20, 30 years to get a brain cancer from a cell phone, but you can have a disturbed heart rate variability with a rhythm disturbance within 5 minutes, especially if you have vulnerability with the heart, like a hidden bypass tract or an aging heart or a calcification in the conduction system. I see this over and over again as a cardiologist. So, you know, the environment is getting more and more toxic, but, you know, we got to stay positive, just like Tommy told us. We got to stay positive. And basically, we just have to, you know, be mindful, use discernment. And whenever I lecture, Ryan, my biggest fear is children, infants, babies, in utero. When I see a woman talking on a cell phone or having a computer on her belly and she's 6 months pregnant, it drives me crazy. And I walk over to these women and I tell them, you know, what I know. And I tell them I lecture across the country. And I feel we have to protect the unborn and the newborn because they're the most vulnerable to electromagnetics and RF.
And it just seems like, well, we grew up in eras where we didn't have to deal with it, and I guess, you know, we take for granted that we came out okay, and I just can't imagine.
Yeah, how old are you, Ryan?
I'm 38.
38. You're in the generation, the healthiest generation is really my generation because we didn't grow up with computers. And the next healthiest generation is your generation because you got it when you were teenagers. But I worry about now the kids growing up on cell phones, and growing up on computers and these gadgets that they play with, these games that are Wi-Fi.
Oh yeah.
You're 5 years old. that scares me. That really, really scares me. So, the best thing you can do for your kids, Ryan, is you can be an example. If you're talking on a cordless a cell phone and you put it towards your ear, your kids are going to do that. So you got to put it on speakerphone and hold it away from your body. And then your kids will remember, kids will follow what you do, not what you say. If you smoke, they're going to smoke. If you drink, they're going to drink. You know, if you're going to eat unhealthy, they're going to eat unhealthy. It's the way it is, you know. But
is it okay to put a phone next to your bed? If you have your cell phone next to the bed, is that bad?
That's bad. This drives me crazy. When kids put it underneath their pillow and they're waiting for a call, that drives me crazy because that cell phone is emitting radiation 24/7. Ryan, do me a favor. You're a journalist. You're a radio guy. You know, you ask good questions. Read the inserts on these cell phones. Read them. They say they don't want them touching your body. I mean, and look, I can't work without a cell phone. I mean, I have a cell, and I use computers, but you just need to be a little smarter. That's all it is, just be a little smarter. And we can live with this technology because we need technology, and technology saves lives. But if it's used carelessly, it can hurt your life as well.
Well, Dr. Hunter, I want to let our listeners know something because I know there have to be some of you listening right now that are like, oh, my God, everything that this gentleman has just described, I've done. Well, let me tell you, I have done just about everything. I've slept with a cell phone on my heart. I've slept with it next to my ear. You know, there's a big, big wake-up call because, you know, we want to be alive a lot longer and produce more shows and have some more fun. But, wow, this is a really mind-blowing interview, and I want to thank you, Dr. Sinatra. It was really great to have you. And to learn more about Dr. Sinatra, again, we're going to give his two websites. We go to
HeartMDInstitute.com. That's a tongue twister, Ryan.
HeartMDInstitute.com and DrSinatra.com.
Dr. Sinatra. And, Ryan, can I say one more thing?
Yes.
What you just said was so crucial about how you're doing everything wrong. Just remember how God works, what Tommy told us. God puts people in your path. So basically, I was putting you a path not only to have your listeners listen to this, but I was placing you a path to change some of your habits. So I'm your messenger. And
that's the way
God works. So now you're going to use speakerphone and you're going to – and, you know, you can buy an RF device. You can get these RF devices and test your phones and see how much radiation is in your phone. I mean, you know, you can get them. They're out there. You know, just look at radio frequency devices.
You know, you mentioned the word radiation because the other night it was dark outside. I'm like, is there a reason why I'm glowing in the dark? And I'm like, no, it's the radiation.
Could be. It could be.
It's the radiation.
You know? Yeah. Now, there's a good gadget I use. It's www.radmeter.com. They have a website. I think it's an Israeli company that put together this incredible technology. But you can test your cordless phones, your cell phones, computers, and you know, it has a green, yellow, and a red light. And some of these red lights, I mean, you don't want to be 1,000 times more abnormal than what, you know, the body can take. And, you know, these devices, it's like having a German Shepherd in your pocket, Ryan. You know what I mean?
No.
Instead of barking, you know, it has a readout on it. It has a light on it. Some of the devices make a noise. They make a very loud noise. Because remember, you can't see, taste, or feel this RF, you know, radio frequency. But those – and remember, it's the unseen forces that can do more harm and can be more powerful than the seen forces. And the benevolent forces, the spiritual forces, can also do a lot of good. But again, it's these unseen forces that we have to key into. Anyway, it was great talking to you. You were a great interviewer. If you ever want to do this again, I think your questions are so provocative, and I love them. And, you know, keep them coming. I'll be happy to go on your show anytime.
Dr. Sinatra, thank you so much. That was a real great, profound interview. We opened up so many doors. You can learn more about Dr. Sinatra by going to his website at heartmdinstitute.com and drsinatra.com. Real great pleasure, Dr. Sinatra.
Oh, it's great. Great to be with you.
Welcoming back to the program is Mr. Jeff Casper, metaphysical teacher, energy healer, and Ms. Yona Brindis, energy healer and metaphysical teacher. You can learn more about him by going to the website at selfunification.com. Welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi there, Ryan. Thanks for inviting us. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, I mean, we always have a great time with you. And focus of today is going to be on the heart, focusing on the heart. From a metaphysical perspective, how do you perceive the heart and how crucial is it to a person's, you know, being and evolution?
Well, I think that the metaphysical aspect of the heart, you're getting past the ego, you're getting past the mind. So the whole key of the metaphysical heart and the energetic state of the heart is to allow you to have access to the, if you were to call them, faster vibratory rates or divine energies. That's your connection point. So it's very vital.
Okay. Is the heart actually something that would be considered another part of your consciousness where it has its own perception? You know how the brain works? Is the brain and the heart kind of very similar in terms of how they perceive information?
Well, that's a good question. It's actually subject of a lot of research right now. There's more and more evidence that our heart actually has its own electromagnetic field, and with that also its own memory, its own intelligence, if you will. And so from a spiritual, energetic standpoint, without any sort of beliefs or anything, it looks like right now that the very thing that all the ancient teachings and the ancient avatars were trying to convey is that our heart is a pathway to a higher level of consciousness or a higher level of perception, if you will. And this is, I mean, basically what we do is teaching people how to get there, how to hold this space. So there is a lot of talk about that. I mean, the sacred heart is a standing term pretty much in all languages, in all religions. Mm-hmm. So it's not really new. It's just that with people starting to awaken in their sort of heart intelligence, if you will, and wanting more from their lives, they're beginning to have these experiences that are not necessarily coming from their mind's intelligence, but they're coming from their heart's intelligence. And the challenges in opening up this connection, even though it's an innate connection that we all have, is mostly overcoming all the barriers that we consciously or unconsciously put in between our mind, our ego mind, and our heart.
If we're going to look at the mind and we're going to look at the heart, we're going to look at the extreme ends of both, is it safe to say that the mind is the chamber of the ego and the heart is the chamber of the higher self?
In vague terms, yeah, but the ego actually entails emotions and mind mostly. You've got your defense mechanisms and coping patterns that are all linked together with mostly emotions and mind. And as you begin to open up to the heart field and the energy that is there, that actually starts to change all the mind and the emotions and the ego. Because the power that's in your heart field, the power that is in the spiritual realm, if you want to put it that way, or the link to God or whatever description you want to use, they're all similar. That creates the potential for everything else that it has more energy than to change. So the mind has power over the body, and the energy of the heart or the spiritual realm has power over the mind and the body.
Okay. What do you, for both of you, what do you find is a more likely to manifest into physical reality? If you have something that you're very determined in your mind, or you have something that you're very determined in your heart, what carries a greater weight in terms of being able to manifest into physical reality quicker and more effectively?
You know, this is a very important question, actually, because it is the problem that most people, when they begin this journey, don't really know the difference between emotions, feelings, thoughts, and sensations. To answer the question in a short way, you would have to see the different energetic levels of certain energetic states. And of course, the heart level has a higher energetic state and has therefore more power. It creates a larger attractor field, you know, which in terms of manifestation tends to pull in, you know, tends to conspire to create favorable or beneficial circumstances. But the biggest problem, especially in terms of manifestation and what that actually means to manifest from the heart, is that most people don't really know what their heart tells them. And part of that is our conditioning and our separation from our heart. Most of us think that our emotions are what our heart tells us. That is not correct. Our heart can give us guidance, can or has that access to our true inner feelings. But because the sensations, the physical sensations that come with it feel very similar to some of our emotions. Like, I'll make a quick example. You know, when we do something like when we eat a donut, or, you know, when we do something.
Donuts are awesome.
Exactly. It gives us that, you just represented that feeling right there, or that emotion. It's awesome. You know, it just feels really good. And that is a physical response that you're actually expressing with that. You know, there's all kinds of neurotransmitters and all kinds of sort of neurological responses in play, you know, when you have something that really sort of, you know, just sort of triggers your, you know, you're wanting to feel good, like this nurturing or whatever you want to call this. Whereas a feeling is a bit larger of a sensation. It will be more like feeling really, really attracted to wanting to do something, or to wanting to be with someone, or to wanting to be at a certain place that you can't really explain. And it is not really linked to our physical. So a feeling, like a feeling that comes from our heart, a true feeling, as we call it, just for terminology's sake, to get linguistic differentiation here, is something that resonates with your entire body. And from an energetic standpoint, what happens in those states of resonance is that you are resonating with a higher energetic convergence within yourself, which means something that pulls you into, you know, the future, if you will. So the heart, and the difference between the heart and the mind and the feelings and emotions, is that our emotions are mostly tied to our physical responses and to right now, where the feelings can be non-local, they can be non-linear, and they can also come from the future. So this explains why people are attracted to things that have absolutely no link to their reality, in quotation marks, you know, to their past or to what they know. But there is an inner sense that we have, and that emanates through our heart field, that recognizes when we do something that is for our highest good or for our highest potential. And that is what we call feeling. And in conjunction with conscious manifestation, this plays a major role in the ability to discern between those.
And there are some people who I would call them, I guess the terminology would be hopeless romantics. They're always falling in love. They're always finding someone, and they're in love, and they have this emotion. What is the difference between a person who falls in love and it's real love and that's what their heart is telling them, compared to a person who falls in love and it is a reaction for the brain, or it is an addiction for the brain, or it is their brain trying to convince them that they're in love? How do you tell the difference between the two things? What is, and also, what is a healthy way of telling if you're in a healthy relationship love-wise?
Well, the key thing with and that's a huge topic that could be like 14 books, but it's all good. We can do a real quick synopsis. It's the thing about love, true love, the feeling of love, the sensation of love, that's an energetic state. It has nothing to do with another person. It has nothing to do with a relationship necessarily. It's a relationship with life. It's the energetic state you're at. You can love everything. And it's not hippy-dippy. It's you truly have a loving feeling, a loving joy for everything that is around you. That's an energetic state. When you get into loving someone, what most people, I shouldn't say most, the majority out there that experience is a love from a lower energetic state. It's usually emotionally tied, like you just talked about. It's a chemical reaction.
It's a donut.
It's a donut, but the donut gets boring and you go to the next one and all this kind of stuff. All those things happen. It's infatuation. It's, or the words of passion can be in there as well, but passion can continue. But infatuation, there's usually a tie. When you're in a relationship that's based on a lower view of love, if you want to use those words, there's typically no separation. So if I'm with Yona and I can't be who I am without her, or if she would leave me, that would be the end of my world. That is a sign that there's a tie that's not healthy, and that's typically not a sign of healthy love, because then you're basically putting the objectification of love onto a person, as opposed to real love. If I truly love her, I still will be hurt if she leaves me, which I do truly love her, but if she would leave me, of course it's going to hurt me, but if that's the best thing for us, then that's truth.
So the main difference between love and infatuation, if you want to say, from an energetic standpoint, is the alignment.
Right.
And, you know, what most people perceive as love or falling in love is something that originates in our, first, second, and third chakra, in our lower energy centers that are very much so tied to our personal survival, to our physical autonomous nervous system, which means that it can indeed, in those states, it can indeed feel like the end of the world, because mm-hmm. if it is tied to our survival, to be with a certain person, then it, and that explains all the drama that occurs. This doesn't mean that true love now, you know, is such a higher, better love. It doesn't mean that we can transition from falling in love from that sort of lower energetic love into a higher energetic state of love. But that requires us to let go of our ego alignment. So an ego alignment then would be tied to the gratification that I get out of it, what I get out mm-hmm. of this love, yeah. what we call this ego payoff. So what, you know, what is in there for me? Once I let that go and I align myself to, say, but more of an attitude that, you know, everybody has the right to love, and everybody has the right to go through whatever they need to go through, in more of a perspective of a higher or true self love to yourself, then you can also see and accept the love in another person, the true self in another person, and let them go.
There's no attachment to it. I mean, it still can cause pain, but there's no attachment.
And I want to just remind everyone that Jeff and Yona, they do energy work, and they do energy healing, so you can visually see the intricacies of a soul. When you are focusing on a person's energy field, what is a visualization that you will typically see in a person who's got let's say, for example, things that are weighing on their heart, or they've got issues, they've got unresolved anger, unresolved pain. How do you visually see that in a person's soul? And what are some of the things that you are able to do to, let's say, for example, slow down the corrosion of that negative energy upon that person's etheric heart field? Well,
can I say something? I never really thought about it until you asked this, Ryan.
What?
You know what? Those things that weigh on a person's heart, like heart as we use it in the English language, we don't really see it in their heart. It really takes place
all around it. Yeah, occasionally you will see around the heart chakra. You'll see, and again, it depends upon, you got to be real careful with this because it depends upon what energy you're tuning into. So, and depending upon, you know, the person that is doing the work, like I'll usually see it, I used to see it sometimes as ghouls or whatever, but nowadays it's more just about energy, like fragmentation. Around the heart chakra, around that chest area, you'll also see, I think Stuart called it black resonance, where it would be like just black gunk on the chest. But a lot of times what you'll see, like Yona just described, you'll see it bypass that area.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually not in the heart. The drama is that you can't be in your heart, that it builds a barrier or a wall or a disconnection to your heart.
Yeah, usually what you'll see at some point is a person, at least I would say in 80% of people I've worked with, either right off the bat or as they start to work on themselves and let some things go and really try to connect within, you'll see visually a line between their third and fourth chakra or some form of barrier. Or you'll see a loop where it'll go from the third chakra to the fifth chakra or the third chakra to the sixth chakra. And those are all signs of that. It's typically a trust issue. A trust issue in dealing with the fear of letting go. And as that begins to break down, then you'll start to see a bit more flow there. You know, or if a person, there are a few cases too where a person's done maybe a bit too much New Age stuff, their heart chakra will be wide open, but they have no grounding. And that creates a lot of problems.
Okay. So you say wide open, that's somebody who's completely open to all things without any kind of protection.
Right.
And not...
we would call it enlarged.
Well,
you know?
Or if you want to look at psychologically, the first one would be the person who's too rigid of boundaries. Like they're too strict. They don't let anything in. You know, the other one would be they let everything in and they're basically just a doorstop, or they can become one. So a lot of times they see a ton, they feel a ton, but they don't have any energy. And I'm not judging anybody, but the ones I've worked with a lot of times have a lot of understanding because they don't have a lot of understanding of their own emotions and how to balance their center. So those are the typically things you see. But I would say the first with the barriers or bypassing the heart is much more common.
Well, just real quick, I mean, there are people listening to our show, I think I would call them, I'd say, more open. They're very open to certain things. How do you protect yourself? How do you, you know, engage or explore and be open to all things, yet at the same time be protective of your energy, protective of your heart?
This requires a little bit of training because, you know, it's not just that, you know, you want to be open and compassionate with everybody. For most of us right now, there's also like an awakening, you know, of our higher perception happening. So we begin to feel things a lot more. The number of energetically sensitive people is like skyrocketing right now. And for the most part, what we're experiencing when we wake up that way, you know, when our heart opens and when our sensations begin to sort of explode, is kind of like a kid in the candy store. We don't really know how to handle that. And so it requires to learn a little bit of tools, you know, how you can manage and how you can navigate through that. One of the ways to consolidate or one of the ways to protect your heart without shutting it down, without going into those, what Jeff just mentioned, sort of learned or conditioned protection, behavioral protection mechanisms, is to learn how to really feel the energy of your heart and how to center it, how to consolidate it. Of course, there's a multitude of psychic or etheric defense techniques that one can learn, we've created a whole 24-step self-study course around it and a program that teaches people how to do this. But at the end of the day, it's about knowing your own stuff. So the more you know your own stuff, like what Jeff just said, you know your triggers, and you have to kind of be willing to face that and to accept that as part of you. You know, if I have, you know, a certain sort of, in quotation mark, weaknesses, you know, in certain areas, like There are certain things, you know, that I can't really deal with because it triggers too much of my inner wounding. Then that makes me a bit vulnerable energetically, and it makes me vulnerable for other people's energies to enter my heart. We all experience this when we watch movies, for instance, that have a scene in there that triggers something that makes us like completely either cringe or cry uncontrollably, which is of course also what Hollywood is really good at. but to allow this without shutting ourselves down is an art form. One of the things that Jeff mentioned earlier, what we see a lot with people that have been around the sort of spiritual corner, is a misconception and the belief that they have to be open for everybody and that I have to absorb other people's pain.
Yeah.
I mean, the majority of our clients are actually energy workers that cannot handle really the amount of energies that they absorb because they don't understand that it's not about absorbing. So tip number one, okay, to prevent ourselves from sort of uncontrollably absorbing other people's emotions or, you know, any type of negative energy, is to know your own stuff, to know how to consolidate your heart, and to not project any love onto other people, like sort of trying to how do you call this, engulf other people with your love, because that pulls in, you know, their stuff on the tail.
Wow, so if you walk up to a stranger and then you send them love, says, and I wish you peace, you risk pulling it to your...
Not necessarily. If you do this from a place, you know, from a place of total centeredness, you know, and you're doing this without wanting to get anything back. You know, you're doing this just because you can, and because your heart field is so big that, you know, just by the fact that you are, just by the fact that you pass by, you know, it will affect the person. But if you're doing this to, you know, to become special, to get attention, or fix things, you know, and then you inevitably intermingling your heart energies with the other person's energies, and you absorbing this. I mean, I train other energy workers to do this kind of work, and this is the number one issue for everyone who has the absorption and the projection.
Well, the trick or difference a lot of times is that a person who has energetic state that's fairly high, that will happen regardless. You know, if a person has really not developed their energy very well, or they were such at a low emotional state for whatever reason, it could be that's their karma, they could be going through some severe issues in their life, they won't be able to project a lot. You know, if a person's in grief, they can't project a lot, you know, or if they do, it's typically
victimhood
or pain. They just need help. But if a person is at, you know, willingness, or they're at courage, or they're at love, or even peace or joy, they'll automatically, their energy radiates much further. And it's not even something that they do typically consciously. You know, you just might walk by a person, all of a sudden the energy of that person affects you, you know, or it's just their smile. For whatever reason, they're walking around smiling and that affects you. There's no difference there. The difference, what I'm saying between what Yona said, is that it's not the necessary intention. It's just who you are.
So the pushing it out is what creates the problem.
Yeah, the
what Jeff's saying is that when you're at this level of, you know, in these higher states of your heart, we call them higher vibratory states, you don't have to push anything out.
That's good.
Yeah, and that's your biggest protection, is that, you know, you're just as true as you can to yourself and to your heart.
Yeah.
Totally. There are certain tracks that people can listen to. I mean, I know that if you go on YouTube, you listen to a lot of these chakra balancing tracks, and you can listen to it for 15 minutes an hour. They're supposedly balancing your energy fields and portals. If you're listening to a heart chakra balancing music, is that going to be something that's going to ground you or clear things out? Do you recommend saging? Do you recommend using any kind of essential oils? Do you recommend even looking at videos or pictures that will make you happy and laugh? Like, what are some of the most effective and quicker ways to, let's say, clear out the dark from your heart and put your heart in alignment to a more celestial, more peaceful vibration?
Well, aesthetics is key. I mean, as you get higher and higher in your vibratory rate, or faster in your vibratory rate, and you begin to align more and more to being open and loving, you're not going to be attracted to other things. You know, I mean, if you used to like heavy metal, you know, and all of a sudden your vibratory rate increases or goes faster, you won't be able to listen to it very long. You know, so it's as you continue to go and you work on yourself, you find the things that help you clear. And yes, sage is great. Lavender oil is great. You know, what's the wood from South America? Can't think of it. There's Santa Paula wood from South America. Works really well. Walking in nature works great. Listening to classical music. Beauty in general. I mean, going to a museum with beautiful pieces of art in it will aid you.
Yeah.
You know, certain books that have a very good vibratory rate or reading spiritual books of any kind will aid you because it shifts your energy. So if you feel heavy, if you feel going, you feel like you're going down or you feel like you're, you know, you can't handle it, it's a matter of shifting in that moment, realizing it, and then realigning. So that's the whole trick. And yes, if you are aware and you're working on it, you're trying to get out of some of your ego traits and all those kind of things that we talk about and work with, you want to start to replace things. You know, so if you used to go to really intense bars and you used to drink a lot and that's not what you want to do anymore, then you shift that. You know, you get out of those places that have a tendency to be in a lower energetic state.
Yeah, the biggest, probably the best way to answer that is to focus on, you know, how does something make you feel like, you know, how does a movie that you watch, how does that make you feel? Does that make you agitated? Does that make you aggressive? Or does it make you feel calm? You know, does it make you feel sad? And we use all these things, you know, unconsciously for the most part and don't realize how some of the outer energies, you know, actually make our situation worse. So if we find, you know, ourselves in a really low state, you know, it's best to know what can get you out of it, what can help you to shift. It's that very simple thing, you know, sort of, what can help me? And one of the main or most frequently given recommendations to people is get up, take a walk, go out in nature. Nature has very naturally very high frequency, very high resonance, and this has even been proven, you know, countless times. Go get into nature. Drink more water. Water, you know, has a huge effect on our energy. Avoid the things that you already know that are not helping you. You know, don't call the people who you feel even worse afterwards with. You know, so healing. You know, healing is nothing but sort of reinstating our higher vibratory states. Healing happens in a twofold way. It happens through avoiding the things that we already know that make us feel low, and strengthening the things that we know that make us feel stronger. And the best way to do this is to experiment a bit and find what works for you, because there's not the same things that work for everybody. Sage, lavender, and so forth, those things are known clearing agents, you know, that people can use, but it will not really change their emotions. They still have to work through aligning, you know, to higher vibratory states and to really want to shift out of it.
In America especially, I think heart disease is the number one cause of death in the country. And I think it's around worldwide. Is there a particular reason why so many people die from heart disease? And I was wondering if you could please discuss on an energetic level, an energetic way, what is happening to a person's energy field when they are having a heart attack?
Well, I've never have been able to observe a person having a heart attack and see what they look like, but
I've seen it.
What can lead to it?
Yeah, it's
what can lead to it.
It's typically just a disruption. I mean, you know, and sometimes those heart attacks, and again, I've never been in this state of energetic awareness when it's happened because it's too stressful, but it's typically a wake-up call. And sometimes that wake-up call is they leave. You know, they're done here. Other times it's a chance to realign and to kind of have another shot at it. So energetically, well, if it's final, well, you remove yourself from your body and you move on. If you stay and you can heal, then it's about realigning and kind of seeing what you can do to get your energy back up depending upon that process. But please, go ahead.
Yeah, basically what leads up to that is a dystrophy of your heart field, okay? It's like an undernourishment. And so most people do this unconsciously. And the way this happens is that we, like you mentioned earlier, Ryan, you know, we favor our mind, you know, we favor rationalization of things. We dissociate, disconnect from our emotions. We keep a lid on everything, and we're not really living in our heart. And what that does, excuse me, it disconnects us from our heart, and that dystrophies our heart field. And our physical response to that with all kinds of coronary insufficiencies and so forth is that it shows us, it signals us that our heart needs attention, that it needs love. Okay? But of course it's not our physical heart in itself. The physical heart is just like with every sort of physical or somatic response, just our energy system's way of showing us where the problem is. Mm-hmm. So if you were asking how to prevent heart attack and heart disease from happening, then, you know, your subject here of the show is exactly the right one. We in order to prevent heart failure or heart, associated cardiological problems, we need to enter our heart state from a feeling level. And that means, you know, allowing ourselves to truly dealing with our emotions, learning how to communicate our emotions, learning to differentiate between feelings and emotions, and the whole shebang. So the reason why this is number one killer right now is because our society has been conditioning us to really leave our heart out, to either go into the mind or go into the emotions, but never really to go into the heart. And this,
I was just going to say, do you think that the types of food that a person consumes will ultimately have an impact on the vibration of the heart?
And the other thing too is as you start to heal, or as you start to open up or get your energy starts to vibrate faster, you'll have a tendency to go towards healthier things anyways. And then the things that you do eat that maybe would be considered unhealthy or a treat or, you know, sweets or whatever, you enjoy them. You enjoy them as opposed to typically when you're not there, you think they're bad or wrong or whatever. So as you shift your energy and it vibrates faster and you begin to feel your heart and begin to be centered, all of a sudden now you kind of start making different choices. You know,
yes, but you have to have a certain level of purity first. So changing your diet, you know, when you have issues with the heart is probably the first and easiest thing mm-hmm. a person can do.
Of course,
and then from there, you know, we call this vibrational, high vibrational living. So I have a whole article series on that, you know, where it shows how the different areas of your life are affected, you know, by your choices. And so as you change, you know, your diet, like say you do a detox and then you start doing certain shifts with your diet, you know, your heart will respond. And then, you know, your entire energy body will respond. And what Jeff says, and then you begin to make different choices. You'll feel differently, you know, you'll become more aware of how certain foods make you feel like and how they're really mm-hmm. not beneficial for yourself. So what that really does in a nutshell is it activates your heart's intelligence. And your heart's intelligence, all our heart's intelligence, is the one that can discern, that knows what's good for you and what's not. See, your body doesn't. Your body thinks donuts are the best for 5 minutes, and then it kind of goes and shut down.
Is your heart kind of a mediator from your higher self? Is your heart the one that can actually kind of transmit the messages from your higher self and surrounding spirit and actively?
Well, you can. There's pathways with the mind too, but the heart's the biggest one because the mind's a huge hurdle.
It's the straightest one.
Yeah.
It's also the hardest because we have put so many barriers in front of it. So typically, you know, this whole sort of getting to the place where high vibrational living becomes sort of natural to you, it requires a little bit of rethinking. You know, it requires you to see things in a different way. And we all need to develop, you know, a sort of a different perception of ourselves there. So it doesn't happen overnight. Although when people have access, when they have access to their heart, solution. This is when miracles happen, when people have access to their heart's guidance. Miraculous things can happen spontaneously, can unfold spontaneously. So this is why everybody is talking about the heart, except for that most people misunderstand heart with emotions.
And I want to share with you an experience I've had in the past. I don't know if this is something that we learned from this, but one day I was feeling very thankful for my family, and I know that it was overwhelming. I felt overwhelmed, and I was a little freaked out because I felt so much energy. So what I did was I started watching videos of midget tossing, and it actually kind of lowered me down a little bit, and I felt so much better. And I'm curious to know, is that possible? Can you actually be in an alignment where, I guess, you were feeling an overwhelmance of love, of peace, but that could be dangerous for you? That could be maybe, you know, trying to trigger your heart or accidentally trick your heart, saying, listen, you know, maybe we're filled with love, maybe it's time to move on. I mean, can you actually put yourself in a bad or dangerous position from having too much compassion or too much love?
Well, as long as you're from your heart center, no. I mean, you know, if there are things like compassion fatigue that they discuss when a person is taking on too many things, like people who are in the counseling world or psychological realm of work can go into a place in maybe a place of, you know, severe damage or whatever, and they keep talking to people and they absorb too much because it's just too much. That's compassion fatigue. So at that point, yeah, compassion can be a bit too high, but that's a mental concept. When what you're talking about, it sounds as if you maybe got overwhelmed by the higher frequency. And that can happen. Sometimes, especially when you first start to connect with your heart, those vibratory levels that are, you know, at love and so forth and peace and joy, they can make you feel a bit almost not, well, you're connected, but you're connected differently. And it can feel a bit odd, or it can feel like you're a bit too flighty. Like you probably felt overwhelmed to the point where you got, I'm losing words here, but you get kind of, a buzzy feel, like you're almost not here.
Yeah, it a little scary too, because I didn't know what it was, and I was like, oh geez, I hope this doesn't trigger.
Well, yeah, it triggered opening up your heart.
Yeah,
so,
but
yeah.
It's not dangerous, but it needs to be practiced. This is why what we talked about with, you know, developing certain disciplines or training things. You know, working within, you have to really practice to be able to hold these states and feel, be in the physical, in the moment at the same time.
You know, and sometimes too, when it gets, especially early on, when a person gets used to those fields, things like eating heavy foods or, you know, taking a little extra sleep, whatever you need to do to kind of adjust to it, that's very normal. Midget tossing, I probably wouldn't recommend that.
It was only to bring me back. I don't know. I felt like when I was doing it, I'm like, oh, obviously this is probably not productive for an evolution, but I think we've kind of calmed down a little bit.
Because what you did is, I'm not judging anything, but that conscious level, that's probably much lower. So what it does is it brings you right down. For example, like the other night, and this is way extreme, we went through an energy process and somebody in the process had a very low energetic issue pop up, like extremely low. And I was helping Yona kind of clear it, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, which is nothing I ever watch, this video popped up on my computer. I must have bumped something, and the video was of a very it was a heavy metal band. I won't say the name, but the energy of that, and I only watched like 5 seconds of it, wondering what the heck this came up from. But it was so low that it destroyed my energy for 30
really?
Seconds, because the energy of that field was so low, like probably below shame, that it just annihilated anything that I had. Now, and it took me a minute or two to realize what had happened. Well, what happened was the energy that we were working with to clear jumped a little bit into the field where I was at, and that was what prompted the thing to come up, and then I just had to work to realign again. So that's what happens. It's no different. If I'm in a very high energetic state and person walks in and they feel that, they can also get an elevated field from that. So it works both ways.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I wanted to just bring to everyone's attention that you may be surprised, but consumption of pornography is apparently at an all-time high, and the United States makes more pornography by far. And there's a gentleman named Chris Hedges. He's an author, and he wrote in one of his recent books called Empire of Illusion, talking about a trend of pornography where it is not just, you know, the 70s music where they have the corny music coming on and something happens, but it's becoming very abusive, where, you know, men and women are not just objectified, but they're actually, you know, having violence done to them. And the reason why I bring this to your attention is because so many people watch it or engage in that, are they in one way, shape, or form causing physical damage to their heart by engaging in a frequency that would promote violence or promote such a lower level of energy?
Yeah, well, not necessarily the heart off the bat. Eventually it could, but that's a huge topic that is becoming very rampant, and you're dealing with a very low energetic state. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, you know, that's just the industry. The porn industry is a very low energetic state. Mm-hmm. So what you're also doing typically with that is you're adding in the component of satisfaction, pleasure, to a very low energetic state. So you're now actually creating a loop between pleasure and a low energetic state. So that nails it right there. So that's usually the issue. And then you throw in the visual component, especially for men a lot of times, it can be really damaging to how they perceive women, how they perceive men, how they move forward in relationships. Because if that's all you watch, you would begin to assume. And that's and there's multiple levels of damage that are done through that.
Right, and I just have two more quick questions. I appreciate you being here for your time. Are there any particular colors that you can wear or that you can have within your house that trigger a higher vibration or a higher resonance with your heart?
What do you think, Emma? She's better with colors than I am. Yeah.
There's colors that are probably good to avoid. So colors do have an effect on other people's reactions, and reactions with the emotions. So, you know, like if a woman, for instance, wears red, you know, that especially when a woman wears red, that can trigger a lot of, like, sort of aggressiveness in men, and so to speak, and not very productive, you know, if this is if you want to really connect through the heart. There are some colors, you know, that that work for us, that will calm us down, that will align us a little better, but they may not be the exact same as for others. There are some colors that have stronger triggers to sort of neurotransmitter to sympathetic reactions. Red is one of those colors. Black is probably a color that helps to be a little less attracting energies a little less. So the black can be an energy that's a bit more neutral, versus white, you know, can attract a lot of attention as well, but it can also reflect energy. So I don't really know if this is the right way to think about these things, because we're talking about inner values. Mm-hmm. and we're talking about inner resonances. And if we really want to communicate and live with other people on a heart level, then all these things, you know, whether it's our zodiac, our gender, what we wear, what perfume we use, all these things dissipate and are really not important anymore. So those are props. They can help when we're in a very, very low state. So if I know, you know, when I wear my favorite purple t-shirt, I feel better about myself, well, then go ahead and do that. But it's most of the time, it's not the color, it's really the feeling that you have towards it. And if that can help, then I would say yes, do it. But to go about it and make a science out of this, you know, I can only wear purple, or I can only wear white as a rationalization, that doesn't really have anything to do with the heart field.
The final question, it's a two-part question, is this. There are people out there who are really looking for the love of their lives. They're really, you know, they want to find true love, or they want to find somebody that they can just settle down with and find that, you know, true love. By focusing on their lack or their, you know, loneliness and not having the love of their life, are they kind of delaying the day or preventing themselves from finding their true love, or is that one way going to help them find it quicker? No. I'm just curious.
If you focus on lack, you're going to get lack. That's the okay. old sales saying, what you dwell on, you dwell on. That nails it. So, or what you'll do is you'll attract people that either one have a lot of lack or who like to prey on people who have lack, you know? So that's, if you want to go out and find the person that, of your dreams and you know what your dreams are, well, then become your dreams. Align to that energy of your dreams, and then that person will start to show up, or people like them.
Excellent. Mr. Jeff Casper, Miss Yona Brindis, I want to tell you what a great honor it is to have you back on the program. As always, you guys always bring so much great knowledge, great information. To learn more about you, please go to our website at selfunification.com. There are a lot of great events that Jeff and Yona do. You definitely want to sign up. They've got a lot of great courses that they teach. So highly, highly recommend checking out their site, checking out their courses. Jeff and Yona, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan.
Okay, everyone, that concludes today's edition of the Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show. Special thanks to our incredible guests, Mr. Steven Sinatra, Ms. Yona Brindis, Mr. Jeff Casper. Special thanks, as always, to our virtues, Miss Carrie O'Connor, Miss Laura Lynn, Miss Lisa Kaza, and Miss Constance Stellis. To learn more about the Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show, please go to our website at outerlimitsradio.com. Till the next time we meet, my friends, wishing upon you an abundance of peace, love, and beers. Take good care, and thank you so much for listening.